From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing things and say things to you on the radio instead. Later in this episode, Michael Arard will join us to discuss the unbridled joy of word geekery. But first things first, we've got news to discuss. Joining me in the studio is Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque, who earlier today suggested Thanksgiving turkeys could be stuffed with habanero hush puppies, which I think is a fantastic idea. Welcome, Melissa.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
And joining us by phone is staff writer Emily Deprang, who I've been told is worthy of wielding the powers of Thor. Welcome, Emily.
Hi.
Emily, I understand you have a story for us about an inmate processing center, and that leads me to have one question, which is, what the heck is an inmate processing center?
Well, it's a jail if you can't get something built by calling it a jail. So on November 5th, the Harris County voters decided that they did want a new joint county-city inmate processing center. Now, what jails do is receive inmates and then either keep them to serve county time or send them to keep them until they go to court or send them, you know, to prison or do whatever jails do. I mean,
right.
All jails are kind of inmate processing centers in part, at least.
Sure.
But basically, the Harris County Jail is operating almost at capacity again after having spent a couple of years lower than capacity. And there's some different reasons for that. But the city and county have been trying to get voters to approve a new joint city-county processing center, parentheses, jail, in 2007 and in 2009. The voters shut it down. They said no both times. So this time, when they put it on the ballot, they called it a joint inmate processing center and insisted that even though it did include new beds, since they were only misdemeanor Class C misdemeanor beds that would keep people for 72 hours, that it wasn't a jail. So that's how it got passed. It passed with like 456 votes out of 224,000 cast.
Okay.
So it was a real squeaker.
Right. So is it a jail?
It is. It is a jail. It's a jail with bells and whistles. It's going to have space for some of the social services and mental health services for people to be diverted to those immediately when they come in instead of kind of getting those services sort of an ad hoc basis. It eliminates the overlap of having a city and a county jail system, so the city will stop having jails run by its police officers. They'll just be the county jail and the city-county jail system, and the city will just pay the county per inmate and also pay a chunk of change for the $70 million facility. So it is a jail, but it's a new, updated, nice jail. It's short term. It's like an airport waiting area that you can't leave ever, or I guess until they tell you you can. It's kind of a jail.
That sounds like jail to me.
Yeah, that pretty much sounds like jail.
Yeah, it's a lot like jail. One of the main criticisms, I mean, there are criticisms from a couple of points of view. One is, oh my gosh, you guys, it's a jail. What would this Brave New World speak stuff is unacceptable, and then, which it's not to that level, but still. And then the other criticism is just that there are things that Harris County can be doing to have a lower jail population, and that wouldn't address some of the other issues like the overlap that the processing center will. But there are ways that Harris County could be lowering its inmate population. Like it's according to State Senator John Whitmire, Harris County is the last county that's still treating trace cases of crack cocaine as felonies. Still prosecuting those as felonies. So that's a controversial thing that puts more people in jail rather than being, you know, being in jail, being processed as felonies. rather than misdemeanors. That's something that's affected the inmate population. And another is that Harris County very rarely issues personal recognizance bonds to poor people. So people who can't afford to, even if they are found, you know, even if they're suspected of nonviolent crimes, they're not being, if they can't afford bond, then they're just staying in the jail. And so the county is paying for them. They're not going to work, not going to the doctor, and they're not a threat to society. So that's the kind of thing that could be, you know, a cheap and easy fix if Harris County issued those at the same level as other counties.
So basically, if Mayor Ford were to come to Harris County, they'd put him in jail?
Yes. Oh, and how? Yeah, his
processing center.
They would put him in a processing center, right? Exactly. He would be processed for some time, I think.
Well, Emily, thank you for sharing that story.
Sure.
Joining us now is Rachel Pearson, a student at UTMB in Galveston and the author of a piece we recently published called Texas's Other Death Penalty. Her piece is a firsthand account of what it's like to work for a volunteer clinic and come to grips with a healthcare system in which patients die from treatable conditions. Rachel, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, many of the themes in Rachel's piece are hardly new. Melissa has been covering stories about UTMB for years now. Melissa, can you fill us in a little bit on the background?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I want to give a real shout out to, if you haven't read Rachel's story already on the Observer website, you should go and check it out because it really gives you an on the ground picture of what is happening right now with healthcare in Texas and the so-called social safety net that supposedly exists, which really doesn't exist. And Rachel really gives you, in-depth look at what is really happening, that people really are needlessly dying from treatable conditions, which is a real shame in a wealthy country like ours that things like this are happening. So I've been covering UTMB since Hurricane Ike back in 2008, and that's when they, you know, I guess since 2005 they had really started making more of an effort of not treating uninsured people. And the reason this is such a big deal is because the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston, UTMB, is a state-subsidized nonprofit teaching hospital, and it's really been sort of the heart of the social safety net for Texas for a century.
Right.
I mean, it's a last-ditch effort. If you can't get treatment and you're uninsured or indigent in Texas, then UTMB is the place you're going to go. And so when UTMB and a lot of really nurses and doctors go to UTMB for that reason, because they really want to work and help uninsured people, and they want to work with this population of people, and they realize, you know, they're mission oriented. So it was a real cultural change for medical people at UTMB when they started moving away from treating the uninsured. And
how did doctors react to that? What did they do? Did they leave? Or,
well, some people left, and I mean, I started paying attention to it when a doctor, Dr. Snyder, who was a doctor at UTMB, wrote a column about how he was really disappointed, you know, that that UTMB was not treating indigent people anymore. And he was actually responsible for the program. It's called DAMP, where they do an assessment to decide which uninsured people that they'll treat, you know, who have like really serious illnesses. And at one point, he didn't see any DAMP referrals at all come across his desk. So he went to inquire, you know, what's going on? And they said, well, you know, this is what we're doing. We're going to start investing our money and building on the mainland, you know, away from Galveston, and we're going to start going after those wealthier insured patients. So, so that they could be fiscally sound. And I mean, it's complicated because they receive state funding for indigent care, and that was their mission.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a very convenient political sort of rhetoric in the legislature, the state legislature, to say that there is a social safety net. People can get treated at the ER. So, you know,
right.
status quo. And yeah, you all feel free to jump in.
Well, something that I really appreciated in one of your pieces about this, Melissa, was when you noted that, you know, it's one thing for a private hospital to choose not to do charity care. And you said that there was something like, you know, 2% of most private hospitals, so about 2% of their care was charity care, something like that. And public hospitals was something like 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 14%.
But the UTMB, you know, after this change, was doing something like 3.3%. So
right.
they were really getting the tax break of a public hospital, but pulling the weight in charity care of a private hospital.
Right. Yeah, and I don't think, you know, people were aware of that. They were still thinking, you know, I can go to UTMB, worst case scenario, and, you know, when in fact UTMB was pretty much turning people away in droves.
You said it there. I mean, the people they took, the percent of care of people that they took that were charity cases, that it's like how many people they turned away went up like threefold. It was 30-something to 90-something, was it not?
Yeah, in 2011.
Over the course of just like 6 years or something like that.
Yeah, in 2011, they denied 91% of the uninsured.
In
people.
What year?
In 2011, they denied 91%, and in 2005, they turned away 35%. So that's
right.
that's a huge increase.
Right,
that's a massive Threefold. Increase. Yeah.
Yeah, and in Rachel's piece, we really see what's happening with the people who are being turned away. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
this sort of facade of like, you know, oh no, you still there's still somewhere you can go, but there really isn't anywhere. I mean,
right.
when in, I guess it was 2011, I did a piece on a young man in his mid-20s who had liver cancer, and he went to UTMB, and I think they stabilized him in the ER and then sent him away, and he bounced around to different clinics,
mm-hmm.
and by the time somebody really, really tried to help him, the tumor was already so large that they couldn't save him, you know, and it was just,
mm-hmm.
he was just batted around like a ping pong, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he could have survived if he had insurance or been treated.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer, and we're discussing healthcare in Texas with Rachel Pearson, a UTMB student who recently wrote a firsthand account of coming to grips with a healthcare system in which patients die from treatable conditions. Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about your piece?
Sure. So I am a student director of a student-run free clinic on Galveston Island that is a primary care provider for about 2,000 people in Southeast Texas. Our clinic is related to UTMB, but as Melissa was explaining, UTMB has drastically cut the amount of charity care or indigent care that they provide over the last 7 years or so. And so people who are uninsured in our area come to St. Vincent's, which is the free clinic, and we're able to provide good primary care, but when our patients need more advanced care, like surgery, chemotherapy, cancer care generally, we cannot often get it for them. And so I wrote about a few patients that I've seen who have suffered really extremely from not being able to get comprehensive care for their diseases. A couple of patients who have died from cancers while being cared for by students here at St. Vincent's. And not only is the problem with UTMBs moving away from providing charity care, but the problem is also with state policy decisions. I write about how we were hoping when the Affordable Care Act started to come into action, we were hoping that the model of care that we provide would drastically change and that we would be able to get most of our patients on insurance and we would have fewer patients and they'd all be able to get what they needed medically. But unfortunately, because Texas declined to expand Medicaid, most of our patients who are, you know, working class and poor people are still without insurance and will not be able to afford insurance even under the Affordable Care Act. So that was really painful for us as providers, and obviously even worse for our patients. We felt sort of abandoned by the system, and our patients certainly have too.
One of the things that really struck me about your piece is it sounds like it's not, well, obviously it's not just you guys who are grappling with this, but one of the examples you give is that UTMB turfed a couple of people to your clinic who had like broken arms, you know, and knowing that there wasn't a whole lot you could do for them, but hoping that maybe something could be done for them.
Yeah. So Merle Linehan, who was the leader of the Galveston County Free Care Monitoring Project, has this idea that St. Vincent serves as a moral safety valve, which means that when people at UTMB, when a patient comes into the ER, the ER does a triage to see how severe their illness is. And then if the patient doesn't need immediate life-saving treatment, like if they're not bleeding to death right there, then they do a financial screening. And uninsured patients are often denied care after the financial screening.
Right.
And so the people who have to give that news are often nurses or doctors, and it's very painful for them to have to give that news. So instead of saying, I'm sorry, you just have to go home, there's nothing we can do, they say, go to St. Vincent's. And so those patients come to St. Vincent's, and we do the best we can for them. But, you know, in the cases, we've actually had two patients show up from the ER with broken bones, and it's just not an appropriate referral.
Something that, you know, what killed me about your piece is that, you know, I thought, as somebody that reads this stuff and follows these, it's not like I didn't know personally what all of the numbers about Medicaid and Melissa's great work about UTMB, and also about what it means not to expand Medicaid, and of the, you know, what is it, 9,000 people a year dying avoidably just specifically because of not expanding Medicaid. Is that right, Melissa?
Yeah. I mean, the real tragedy is the politicization of healthcare. I mean, I worked in the Texas legislature for 5 years, and when you're sitting there in the Capitol and you hear these debates, there's a real unwillingness to acknowledge the reality of what's happening. The topic becomes so politicized that you know, reality doesn't really work its way into the debate, and
right.
And it's a real failure of the political leadership, I think, that, you know, we see people needlessly dying like this.
Right. And then I see, you know, I think that I follow these things, and then I read a piece like Rachel's, and it makes me realize that I have not even really grokked what it means for us not to have insurance, for us to treat people through the emergency room. This heartbreaking story she tells about this couple and the husband being, who has cancer and is sent to and goes to the emergency room, and, you know, the husband dies of the cancer, and his partner receives a $17,000 bill for the ER visit. And it's just inhumane.
Right.
Everything about it is inhumane. And that's what shocks me, and what's so powerful about good writing is that even somebody who thinks she knows this story, I didn't really know this story until I read Rachel's piece.
Rachel, can you tell me what kind of care is appropriate for St. Vincent's to handle?
Primary care. I mean, frankly, I think that I would like for charity care clinics to not exist. I mean, I would like for there to be a medical system that was sustainable and comprehensive, that cared for all Texans and all Americans. Because as we have seen from the debacle at UTMB, charity is not reliable. We're working very hard here to take care of our patients as best we can, and I do not think that St. Vincent's Clinic is going anywhere, but I think that our patients deserve a medical system that they can rely on, that's not going to be subject to the, you know, the whims of UTMB administration or of the Texas legislature. You know, charity is a nice thing, I guess, in a desperate medical system where there's no other option, but Texans don't like to rely on it, and they shouldn't have to.
Yeah, it's also incredibly expensive in the long run, too. I mean, they have these debates in the legislature about the high cost of caring for the indigent and so forth, but ER care is some of the most expensive care there is. So really, the system's just so broken. I mean, when you talk to people in the medical field, they're just like, this isn't sustainable. It's amazing that it's limped along as long as it has.
Well, Rachel, thank you. Rachel, thank you very much for sharing that story with us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you.
You can read Rachel's story, Texas's Other Death Penalty, on texasobserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And I have with me Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer. Welcome, Brad.
Hello. Good to be here.
Also with us is Michael Arard, a language journalist who hopes to marry language geekery with long-form journalism in a new magazine called Schwafire. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, guys.
Can you give us an example of long-form geekery?
Long-form language journalism, yeah. I mean, I think a really good example would be some things that have run in The New Yorker within the last 2 years. Josh Ford did a piece on invented languages. There was a piece on corporate naming and the linguistics behind that. And then I did a story for The New York Times Magazine in September about the history of online comments that I would put in that genre too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a good piece. I'll jump in there. Michael, you've give a little bio from you. You've written for more outlets than I care to list here, including the Texas Observer, not as recently as we would like, but also I've written two books about language, Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders and What They Mean, and then more recently, Babble No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. You've carved out a real nice niche for yourself here as a language journalist, which I'm not sure that's necessarily a category, although we're trying to make it one. Tell me about the inspiration for moving from a journalist in this area with a lot of experience into wanting to get into the other end of things and start a magazine about this sort of material. What was the inspiration? And part two of that question is I want to ask you to tell me where the name came from.
So that was the name was part two. I'll get to that.
Okay.
You know, I've been as someone who's I'm trained as a linguist, you know, and have worked as a journalist, you know, doing stories about language and other things for over a decade. And I had been, you know, in conversations since about 2005, 2006, it seems like, with people about starting a popular linguistics magazine. Linguistics is a, you know, discipline that is really interesting, but really not understood very well. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, but like a lot of scholarly disciplines, kind of gets stuck in its own ruts and can't figure out a way to communicate what it knows and what it has to a wider audiences. Schwafire is not going to just be about linguistics and for linguists, you know, it's really about speech, language, communication in the modern world, finding the human in the language stories and finding the language element in the human story and putting those together in a long-form way. And it mm-hmm. really seemed in the last year that a couple things had matured to the point where, a vision of what this could be cohered for me, and I decided to take the leap. And part of it, you know, was motivated as much by the changes within the journalism world, both good and bad. You know, there's many more outlets for stuff, but the pay that's available and also the appetite for language stuff has changed. So I'm interested in really digging in and being able to follow something for a long time. That history of online comments piece that I did, that took, you know, a good bit of research to be able to put together. And so I'd like to give other people the opportunity to do that same sort of thing, spend a lot of time with a language topic and dig into it, not just in text, but in audio and other kinds of multimedia, depending on the story. So there are lots of language stories that don't get done because they can't be done in text or they can't be done in audio. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically about stories about sign language, where there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. You know, that, you know, language enrollments in American universities in sign language have gone through the roof in the last decade.
Is that right?
It's also very popular in high schools. And also issues like typography and signage, just mm-hmm. the whole issue of language in our environment would be another interesting one to tackle, but you can only do it more easily in a digital format. This mm-hmm. will be digital too, so you'll be able to read it on your phone, on your iPad, and I won't be really tied to the high cost related to production of paper.
Okay. That's a good segue into the second part of that question. Tell me about what's the origin of Schwa Fire for folks who don't recognize it.
Some people have joked that it's my play on the name of William Sapphire, who was the prominent political reporter and language columnist for the New York Times Magazine. And while I think that's a pretty good joke, I can say that there is actually no relation.
If you get that joke, you're the audience for this magazine. Is that a safe assumption?
If you get that joke. Well, right. If you know what a schwa is, so a schwa is a vowel. It's sort of the vowel of in English. It's kind of the final vowel in sofa. It's sort of a shibboleth. If you know what a schwa is, then this is a magazine for you.
Mm-hmm.
Schwa Fire, because people like to say schwa, for one thing. And fire, it is something that works across cultures, and it speaks to passion and enthusiasm.
Okay. I'm told that we're down to just about our last minute, so I want to give you an opportunity to just make a real quick plug. You're kickstartering this project to try and get it off the ground. Just real briefly, can you tell us about the terms and where we can find it?
Yeah, so people can, Schwa Fire, SCHWA-FRE.com has a link to the Kickstarter. There's a number of different pledges and reward levels. We are, I'm excited that at about 9 days in, we are over 50% funded.
Okay,
wow. On this.
Great. Well, are we at the end here, Jonathan?
Yeah, I believe so.
We're going to have to wrap it up. Michael, thanks very much for calling in. And
yeah, hey,
it's a really interesting project. Looking forward to seeing how it progresses.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And thank you, Brad.
Adios.
Bye.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.